Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A week of rulings, reconciliation, and a rigged election. The Supreme Court gave a big victory to gun rights supporters.
After being involved in this case for 6 years, I'm finally going to be able to defend myself in my own home.
Axis of evil no more. President Bush removes North Korea from the list of terror-sponsoring states.
If North Korea continues to make the right choices, it can repair its relationship with the international community.
And voting begins in Zimbabwe. Only one candidate, ruling strongman Robert Mugabe. Citizens forced to the polls. Unclear what voters are really thinking.
We as Zimbabweans need to decide the direction that we want our country to take. So we can only do that by voting.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Gerson, columnist for The Washington Post and fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a former speechwriter and advisor to President Bush. His new book is Heroic Conservatism. Michael, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
Also joining us from Washington is Amy Sullivan, senior editor and writer at Time Magazine. Her new book is called The Party Faithful, How and Why Democrats Are Closing the God Gap. Amy, welcome back to you, too.
Hi, Jane. It's good to be here.
Thank you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Jane, Amy, and Michael.
So let's begin with the big Supreme Court decisions this week. First, this landmark ruling, which protects an individual right to own a gun for personal use. It was a 5-4 ruling which overturned the District of Columbia's ban on handguns. Michael Gerson, let's start with you. What did you make of it?
Well, it was it's a deep and long American tradition, a pretty plain interpretation of the Constitution. This is a document, these amendments that deal with individual rights. And that's what the court interpreted. I think that in some ways, the result, John McCain has attempted to take advantage of this, to contrast his opinion with Obama. But in some ways, the other result going the other way might have been worse for Obama. It would have highlighted his support for gun control in the past more than this one. And I'm not sure it has a lasting influence on the election.
Talk more about the politics of that in just a moment. I want to play a clip first from Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, who criticized the court's decision to uphold the right to own a handgun. He says Chicago has laws restricting that right.
If they think that's the answer, then they're greatly mistaken. Then why don't we do away with the court system and go back to the old West, you have a gun and I have a gun, and we'll settle on the streets, if that's their thinking. And to me, this is a very frightening decision for America.
Amy Sullivan, you hear the disgust in the mayor's voice. Does he have a point? Is there some sort of urban-rural split on this issue?
Well, certainly as someone who lives in Washington, D.C., I feel a little more affected by yesterday's decision than perhaps my family out in the middle of Michigan. But I think Mayor Daley is concerned because his city does have a similar ban. And already yesterday, at least one suit was filed to see that overturned. When you talk to people on both sides, the one thing everyone agrees on is the fact that this is going to lead to many more lawsuits as people try to kind of push the boundaries to see what's allowed. You know, we've now seen two bookended decisions, one in 1939 that kind of said there is no blanket right to bear arms, and now this one that says, you cannot have a blanket ban on arms. And there's a lot of room in between. The court yesterday was very clear about the fact that there are permissible restrictions, but we're going to see a whole spate of lawsuits to try to push around and see what those restrictions are.
Let's listen to a little bit of that. Actually, from the Supreme Court itself, the oral arguments in Washington, D.C. This is from early in March. Here, Chief Justice John Roberts is questioning Walter Dellinger. He's an attorney for the District of Columbia on whether the right to bear arms is limited to state militias or whether it's an individual right. Here's Dellinger first.
And even if the language of keeping and bearing arms were ambiguous, the amendment's first clause confirms that the right is militia related. It's essential
If you're right, Mr. Dellinger, it's certainly an odd way in the Second Amendment to phrase the operative provision. If it is limited to state militias, why would they say the right of the people? In other words, why wouldn't they say state militias have the right to keep arms?
Chief Justice Roberts ultimately sided with the majority. Jack Beatty, what do you make of this very narrow decision?
Well, Justice Stevens, in his dissent, called it a decision that will create, quote, a dramatic upheaval in the law. And as Amy said, that may lead to further, and is already probably leading to further litigation about city ordinances. But, you know, what I'm struck with here is the way the conservative court, the conservative justices, who are praised for their judicial restraint and their lack of judicial activism. That's supposed to be the watchwords of conservative jurisprudence. They have been both active and unrestrained. Active in striking down a precedent going back to 1939, 40 different times this precedent that there is no individual right to own guns has been used by the courts, and unrestrained in invalidating a law passed by a local, a local legislature. And so, it's really kind of a case where it looks almost as if the conservative justices wanted it was an outcomes based decision. They wanted to have this outcome because it favors their views about guns, but and they were willing to throw out their shibboleths about restraint and activism to get there.
Court also ruled this week in another case that the death penalty is unconstitutional as punishment for the rape of a child. It was another 5-4 decision, split decision, which overturned the death penalty laws in Louisiana and five other states. Michael Gerson, your reaction to that particular ruling?
Well, you know, my immediate reaction was to go back and look at some of those, the oldest precedents, like in the Hebrew scriptures about an eye for an eye. That is a limiting principle in Hebrew law. It says that you can't do more than an eye for an eye. And so I think that is an old tradition of justice in a certain way, that there has to be proportional punishments when it comes to these things. And that's what the court decided, that, you know, the death penalty may be justified in some cases, but there has to be it has to be proportional to the crime. My reaction there is, I think there's going to be a lot of reaction in state legislatures, which you've already seen, of outrage, because this is the most heinous of possible crimes, you know, in so many ways. But there's a broad reassessment going on capital punishment issues among the public and the courts, and I think this is part of it.
Michael, you brought up the politics of at least one of these decisions. I'm wondering how the panel thinks about these Supreme Court decisions, especially the gun ownership ruling, how that might play into presidential politics. Amy Sullivan, you first. How did Barack Obama or John McCain's comments about these cases strike you this week?
Well, I certainly agree with Michael that had the gun case gone the other way, it would have been much more difficult for Barack Obama. This kind of allows him to underline what he has talked about when he goes out into rural areas. Certainly in 2004, when he was campaigning in southern Illinois, he talked quite a bit about the right to own guns and his support of that right. So this is a little easier for him than withstanding, you know, a version of what we saw in 2004 with the gay marriage decision, where there would have been quite a bit of outrage on the right, and he would have been associated with what was seen as judicial activism, I think. With the death penalty case, it's a little trickier. This is one of the reasons we have courts, and it was, I think, good to see that this sort of very emotional kind of issue can be decided by the court in a way that politicians are just not free to do the same thing. And I think you saw that with the responses of both Barack Obama and John McCain kind of criticizing the decision.
Michael Gerson, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, that is the appropriate role of the courts, is to, you know, as a, not subject to these kind of public pressures, to make these kind of difficult interpretations of the law. And I disagree, though, that somehow on the gun issue that this was a predetermined outcome, although it was broadly expected. It was broadly expected because the language of the Constitution itself is pretty plain. And people like Scalia, you know, they have a respect for precedent, but their primary commitment is the words of the Constitution. That's his constitutional approach. And so I don't think that that was in any way unexpected or illegitimate.
Jack Beatty, you have the last word before we go to break. The politics of these Supreme Court decisions.
Well, I agree with the other two on that. I was disappointed in Obama, though, on the death penalty case. It would have been a great chance for him to talk about just what Amy mentioned, the way legislators are stampeded by public frenzies and fears into voting for things that violate fundamental rights. And it's a great chance to defend the autonomy of the court and the court's office as standing above, stampeded majorities. I would have liked to have seen him say that, but I guess that's hoping for too much.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the week in the news. Joining me today, Michael Gerson, Washington Post columnist and former speechwriter for President Bush, Amy Sullivan, senior editor at Time Magazine, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. We were talking in the first segment about the big Supreme Court decisions this week. Before we move on to many other things, I want to welcome a caller into our discussion about this. Myrna is in Malden, Massachusetts. Myrna, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. In the last 5 years, Jane, of this war, we've lost more than 4,000 young Americans. In the same 5 years, right here at home, we have lost 151,000 plus people, American citizens. The majority of these are, as always, in the inner cities, and that's why Mayor Daley and Mayor Menino of Boston are so upset about this ruling, the first time a court case has gone in favor of the gun controls. Warren Berger, who was once a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, a conservative judge, said that the most misconstrued, the most misinterpreted element in our country is the meaning of the Second Amendment. It does not mean that anyone can have a gun that she or he wants to. It referred to the right of a state to have its own militia, because at that time when this was founded, there was no such thing as a national army.
Mm. So different time, different circumstances. Myrna is not happy with the Supreme Court decision. Mike has another perspective. He's in Randolph, Vermont. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having your panelists on. And I'll probably be within a stone's throw of Mr. Beatty in just about 45 minutes down in West Lebanon, a beautiful area. I think with the Supreme Court decision, what happened here is, I think the court has tended to try to stay out of actually coming down really hard about that, because they sort of let things be. Mm. And sort of let the culture work from the Second Amendment and no harm done, you know. But I think they were pushed into a corner here where I actually think that the municipality, D.C. in particular, I think they were pressing the Supreme Court and kind of forcing them into a corner to say the Second Amendment does not allow individual ownership of guns. I thought Justice Scalia's interpretation of the grammar and the logic was justified. I think Justice Stevens' concern is valid. But I think the court actually felt like they had to respond to overreaching on the part of one party, because they were actually trying to get something written in stone about it. Mm. And I think the court said, no, we're just going to come down on the other side. And like you said, we're going to bookend it, and we're going to leave some room for municipalities to deal with problems, but we are not going to strike this from the Second Amendment.
Mike, I appreciate your call, and thanks for your perspectives. We'll get more to your phone calls opinions in just a moment. I want to move on to some more politics here. Let's listen to some sound. Here's from Tuesday. Evangelical leader James Dobson blasted Barack Obama on his Focus on the Family radio program for what he said was, quote, fruitcake, unquote, interpretation of the Constitution, and for his false understanding of the Bible. Dobson was reacting to a speech that Obama gave a couple of years ago in which he said that politicians take into account multiple perspectives on moral issues.
I think he's deliberately distorting the traditional understanding of the Bible to fit his own worldview, his own confused theology.
Michael Gerson, why is James Dobson going after Barack Obama right now?
Well, first of all, James Dobson has a long habit of intemperate statements on political issues, and this is one of them. But if the point he was making is that Barack Obama is not a traditional evangelical in his approach to scripture or his social views, well, I think that's probably true. But I don't think that Barack Obama has ever claimed to be. You know, he comes from a tradition, the United Church of Christ, which is one of the more theologically liberal denominations in America. He's never hid that or claimed anything different. You know, it sometimes leads to different conclusions on things. I think it's unfair for Dobson to accuse him of being something he's never claimed to be. And I also think it's unfair in another way, because the statement that Dobson's talking about was made during Barack Obama's speech to the Call to Renewal in 2006, mm-hmm. which is really a breakthrough speech for Democrats. You know, Obama was making the point that religious influence is absolutely essential to the pursuit of social justice in American history and in American politics of today. That's a big change from some other kind of Democrats as they've approached these issues and seem much more secular. So all around, I think it was a pretty likely a charge that's going to backfire because it's attacking a strength in some ways.
You mentioned that speech, Michael. Let's listen to a piece of it. Here's Barack Obama in his own words in 2006 speaking about the need for politicians to take in a variety of perspectives and opinions when making public policy. He said there's no one interpretation of the Bible.
Which passages of Scripture should guide our public policy? Should we go with Leviticus, which suggests slavery is okay, and that eating shellfish is an abomination? Or we could go with Deuteronomy, which suggests stoning your child if he strays from the faith? Or should we just stick to the Sermon on the Mount, a passage that is so radical that it's doubtful that our own Defense Department would survive its application?
Amy Sullivan, that speech a couple of years ago, but might Obama's pluralistic approach appeal to a lot of religious voters, maybe more than we think?
You know, it's interesting, Jane. I was interviewing just yesterday Doug Kamek, who's a conservative Catholic and a law professor out at Pepperdine, who's also a supporter of Barack Obama this year. And he told me that it was this speech that first made him really sit up and pay attention to Obama, that he had never heard a politician, Republican or Democrat, who really articulated a vision of what the role of religion in our modern public life might be. And so he was somewhat flabbergasted when James Dobson took issue with this speech, because in his mind, it was a real step forward in terms of being able to recognize on both sides that religion does have a real role in our public life, but really grappling with what the proper role is. And so I think you're right. I think there are a lot of religious voters who may not have considered supporting a Democrat in the past, but who really, I think, find some appeal in the way that Barack Obama talks both about his personal faith, but also about the importance of welcoming religious voters into public life.
Michael Gerson, you have a column actually today in The Washington Post where you talk about Obama's challenges, particularly when it comes to reaching out to evangelicals and conservative Catholic groups. Can you expand on that a little bit? What are the challenges?
Well, sure. There's some progress here. If you look at recent polling, he's made progress among mainline Protestants. polling by Calvin College. As you might expect, he shares much of that kind of social justice liberal perspective, which is kind of a Martin Luther King approach in many ways. But I think that he's going to have problems with the evangelical community in particular, because even though it's changing in many ways, evangelicals are much more interested now in environment, much more interested in global disease and development, much more interested in conflict issues in Africa. But they're still very pro-life. And this is an issue where Barack Obama, has not made. I mean, he says some things that are oriented towards outreach, but his policy approach is very it's not even Jimmy Carter's in many ways. It's pretty extreme, and I think that's going to turn off a lot of evangelicals who are searching for a different political model than the religious right. We're looking for something, deeper in their politics than just what they've seen in the past. But I think he's going to have some problems because of those pro-life issues.
Let's cross the aisle for a moment. Amy Sullivan, is John McCain being as aggressive as George Bush was, perhaps, in terms of courting the religious community?
He is absolutely not. When you talk to people who are out there in the faith communities who haven't necessarily been aligned with Democrats in the past, they're hearing from the Obama campaign. And as Michael says, not all of them are responding and becoming Obama supporters, but they're hearing from the Obama campaign. Very few of them have been contacted by McCain's camp. In fact, Obama held a meeting a few weeks ago with a number of kind of center-right religious leaders, including Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, and very few of them, including Franklin Graham, had heard from the McCain campaign at all. They were surprised to have been contacted by a Democrat and equally surprised not to have heard from the Republican. And I think that raises a concern that might actually neutralize what Michael's raised about evangelicals and their pro-life positions, and that where John McCain has talked about abortion, he's really focused on it as a federalist issue. He doesn't talk about the culture of life. He doesn't talk about abortion as a tragedy. He really talks about it as a matter of leaving it up to the states. And that's not sufficient for a lot of pro-life voters. It doesn't give them a sense that it's really something that he feels in his gut.
You've written a piece actually in Time magazine tracking McCain's outreach to pro-choice women, on the other hand, right? What's your reporting on that?
Well, a lot of pro-choice women are under the impression that John McCain is himself pro-choice. That comes from the fact that he is known as a political maverick. A lot of people assume that that means he's moderate and that therefore he must be pro-choice. I would bet that the McCain campaign is fairly happy letting that interpretation kind of sit out there, given the number of pro-choice voters that Republican presidents had needed to pick up in the past. In 2000, about 38% of George Bush's votes came from pro-choice supporters, and only 22% of Al Gore's came from pro-life voters. So Republicans rely much more on the votes of pro-choice voters than Democrats do of pro-life. So this is really a target area that John McCain is going after.
Before I move on, I'd like to bring one more caller in here. Paul is in Bennington, Vermont. He's got an opinion about all this. Paul, go ahead. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
You opened your piece with a quote from James Dobson in which he held that that Obama was twisting the Bible to their own ends. And I thought if you just flipped that so that you said that the quote was about James Dobson itself, it would have been much more accurate.
Thank you. All right, Paul. Jack Beatty, do you want to respond in any way?
Well, yes. I want to take it slightly in a different direction. Obama praises himself in his praise for his pluralistic outlook. Well, he's falling down on that when it comes to Muslim Americans. There's a reason for that. 10% of voters in polls think he's Muslim. In a recent focus group in Virginia, 7 out of 12 independent voters thought he was a Muslim. So he has a problem. And how is he dealing with it? Well, at a rally in Detroit a couple of weeks ago, his people asked, two young women wearing hijabs to get out of the picture. They would be behind the stage. He has referred on his website to the smear that he is a Muslim. And he has not visited a mosque. And, you know, Muslim Americans are a substantial and growing minority of the country, perhaps 1.5 million adult Muslims. Two-thirds of them are immigrants. They're highly middle class. They're eager to assimilate. And according to a Pew poll from 2007, they are assimilating rapidly. However, quote, they're doing that in the face of the overwhelming feeling that mainstream society does not accept them. And particularly this is the case with young, with women and headscarves. 69% of women in this poll said they had reported discrimination against them because of their headscarves. Now, what does Obama do about this? It seems to me here is a great teaching moment for him where he can talk to the bigotry that exists against Muslim Americans, where he can point to their poignant efforts to assimilate, which are which are praiseworthy, and where he can also help himself by saying, "Hey, I am not a Muslim, but even if I were, it would not matter." Mm-hmm. Instead, he's hiding from it.
A teaching moment. Jack, thanks. I want to talk for a moment about the big appearance last night, in fact, of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Appearing together for the first time since the end of the primary season, they showered each other with praise. Clinton urged her top donors to support Obama. Obama announced that he had personally written a check to Hillary Clinton for $2,300 to help erase her campaign debt. Michael Gerson, are we on the road to a unified Democratic Party?
Yeah, for the most part in these situations, with a few exceptions like 1964 and some others, you do have moments of unity at the end of the convention. I mean, it's rare when Ted Kennedy, you know, refused to shake the hand of Jimmy Carter, for example, when he was, you know, got the nomination. Mm-hmm. So these things usually, you know, work out. And of course, you know, Hillary Clinton's intention, whatever her own personal plans are, would be to remain a key player in the Democratic Party, and she doesn't want to burn bridges, and I think that makes a great deal of sense. But the real question is not whether they can get along personally. The real question is whether John McCain has any chance of picking up these more disaffected blue-collar, you know, and Roman Catholic votes in places like Pennsylvania, and you know, or whether they come around, or whether their objections were really to Barack Obama and not so much supporting Hillary Clinton.
Amy Sullivan, what's your take on that in our final minute here before the break?
Well, on Michael's last point, we're already seeing the polls start to really close up on the Catholic vote. Both Obama and McCain are polling equally right now among Catholics. The same has happened with women. In that case, Obama actually has quite an advantage when it comes to women. So while we see stories like today in the Washington Post style section about Hillary supporters who are absolutely opposed to Barack Obama, I think the real story on the ground is that those numbers are fairly small and will continue to diminish towards the convention.
Jack Beatty?
Yeah, and I guess this is all about money, too, isn't it? And I think some Obama contributors, at least from what I read, are not so happy about the idea of paying Mark Penn, who was the pollster and campaign guru of Hillary Clinton, the $6 million that she wants to pay him. They're not happy about that. They're not happy about the idea of paying Mrs. Clinton herself for the millions she loaned her own campaign, as if she wouldn't want to take any financial risk, have any financial exposure to it. So I think there's some resistance even from the Obama people.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. It was a sad week in American comedy this week as George Carlin died, but the jokes kept coming. Carlin was famous for his routine about the seven words you can't say on television. The odds were stacked, he said.
399,993 to 7. They must really be bad.
David Letterman talked about Bill Clinton's plans out on the campaign trail.
Here's good news. Bill Clinton will be out on the campaign trail getting people to vote for Obama. Isn't that what he was doing for Hillary?
And Stephen Colbert gave his take on Energy Crisis 08.
The big story out there continues to be the high cost of gasoline. $4 a gallon. I have stopped traveling anywhere that is not downhill.
Joining me today, great panel, Michael Gerson, Washington Post columnist and former Bush speechwriter, Amy Sullivan, senior editor at Time magazine, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Stephen Colbert talking about high gas prices leads me to John McCain talking about energy policy in Virginia this week. It was a big speech. He said he wanted to offer a $300 million prize to spur the development of clean, energy-powered cars.
Think of all the highest scientific endeavors of our age. The invention of the silicon chip, the creation of the internet, the mapping of the human genome. In so many cases, you can draw a straight line back to American inventors and often to the foresighted aid of the United States government.
Michael Gerson, how does this all fit in with the wider sort of green trend, if you will, in the GOP? Seems McCain is willing to use government to get something done here.
Yeah, I mean, the real departure here is that John McCain is a supporter of a cap-and-trade system for carbon production, which is a bigger deal. But we have prizes, Nobel Prizes, Pulitzer Prizes, Templeton Prizes. This I think, is a minor part of approaching a very large problem that's going to involve, you know, consumption. It's going to involve production. And there's a big debate now about drilling. And it's also going to involve developing, alternatives to oil. The reality is that this is pretty much a crisis, and not just because of a $4 gas. It's because we're pursuing or participating in one of the largest transfers of wealth in human history to some of the least responsible countries on Earth, whether it's Russia or Venezuela or the countries of the Middle East that export terrible ideologies and complicate, a variety of problems in the world. And so there's an urgent necessity here. And these symbols are important, but it's going to require a lot more than that.
Let's get a caller in here to join us. Bob is in Wickford, Rhode Island. Hi, Bob. Welcome.
Hi there, all. A couple quick points on the energy issue. I'm always puzzled when politicians such as John McCain, in fact, Bill Richardson, in one of the debates, considers the challenge of a economical car, an eco-friendly car, as a distant goal. Mercedes has a 100-mile-per-gallon diesel engine in their S-Class car, the biggest sedan, mm-hmm. right now. So it's really not a matter of reinventing the wheel. It's a matter of the political will to just force car manufacturers to make this technology available right now, and then set the goal for 150 miles per gallon or 200 miles per gallon. Mm-hmm. So it's just puzzling. This technology is here right now. And the other quick point I wanted to make was that I think it's incredibly farsighted for Barack Obama to be reaching out to the religious right, because while they've gotten a lot of lip service from conservatives over the years and the Republicans, it's really the Democrats whose social programs reduce the incidence of teen pregnancy and the rates of abortion. So the real success on the ground is coming from Democratic programs.
Bob, thanks. I appreciate your call. I want to move on here for a moment to some international news. Big news out of North Korea today. It blew up the most visible symbol of its plutonium production in this new commitment to halt its nuclear weapons program. Bush administration almost immediately announced that it would remove the country it once described as part of the axis of evil from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. Amy Sullivan, a diplomatic achievement for the Bush administration?
Well, we're certainly seeing some important symbolic moves out of North Korea. And while it remains for the rest of us to see what real substance there is behind this, everything we're hearing, particularly my colleague Joe Klein at Time has been reporting out of Christopher Hill's office, that they are extremely optimistic that there have been some real successes that have been made here. And if so, that's a good step for all the global citizens, I think. But this looks like it could be a real achievement for the administration.
Here's President Bush praising the effort by North Korea, but said much remains to be done.
The United States has no illusions about the regime in Pyongyang. We remain deeply concerned about North Korea's human rights abuses, uranium enrichment activities, nuclear testing and proliferation, ballistic missile programs, and the threat it continues to pose to South Korea and its neighbors. Yet we welcome today's development as one step in the multi-step process laid out by the six-party talks between North Korea, China, Japan, Russia, South Korea, and the United States.
Michael Gerson, I'm curious, has the Bush administration been too beholden to hardliners on this issue for too long in terms of the need to negotiate with these regimes? And do you see this as an example of how negotiation actually works?
Well, on the first point, I mean, the six-party negotiations began in 2003. And the president always said that he had different approaches for these different circumstances, Iran, North Korea, and Iraq. But, you know, the criticism here is that that North Korea is moving towards normalization for in exchange for a single outdated plutonium enrichment plant, and not accounting for uranium enrichment, not accounting for proliferation activities, including possibly to Syria. But there's an important and old foreign policy principle involved here, which is, well, what the heck would you do? I mean, North Korea holds South Korea hostage. They've exploded a nuclear weapon. And, you know, there's an argument here for small step diplomacy because the alternatives aren't that good.
Let's go to a caller who has a thought about all this. Sean is in Newport, Vermont. Sean, welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I agree that small step diplomacy is the way to go. I think it's amazing that maybe the one foreign policy victory of the Bush administration was achieved by negotiation and talking with somebody when their overall policy is to freeze people, freeze countries out that we don't agree with. Mm. I think this is something that Barack Obama can actually run with. You know, that, hey, the one thing that's actually worked was actually talking to people.
Sean, thanks. Amy Sullivan? Yes. Or yeah. Jack Beattie, go ahead,
well,
you first.
And I was going to say, and this comes just weeks after the president, speaking before the Knesset, invoked the Holocaust as, in saying that appeasement, and saying people who want to talk to Iran are appeasers. And of course, we've been talking to North Korea, negotiating with them while allowing them, continuing to allow them to engage in uranium enrichment. With Iran, we say we won't talk to you until you stop uranium enrichment. This is a case of hypocrisy, you could say, but also success. Good for the Bush administration. I was alarmed, though, to hear a Ms. Leverett, I didn't write down her first name, former member of the Bush State Department, I guess, last night on the Keith Olbermann show, say that she was afraid that because Bush had got this victory over the hardliners in North Korea, that Cheney and company would insist on a harder line and perhaps even war with Iran. I mean, she out and out said that as someone who knows how things work inside the Bush administration. And that, I found, was very alarming.
Michael Gerson, I'll go back to you. You're close to the Bush administration. What's your take on that comment?
Well, I was pretty close to the Bush administration, and I've really never heard of the person who said it. So I'm not sure that she is. But Iran is a circumstance, if you look at recent reporting in the Washington Post by Glenn Kessler, where there's significant fears among our European allies that unconditional talks with Iran would actually undermine their position and contradict UN Security Council resolutions. Barack Obama has backed off significantly from a fairly irresponsible position, which, you know, meeting immediately with Ahmadinejad and within the first year, at least, is what he promised. But the Bush administration has always had this position that they're willing to talk, not if Iran gets rid of its nuclear program, just if it suspends it. And it's one of the few items of leverage that we've had in this circumstance. So I don't necessarily consider that an extreme position. There are arguments about whether it's wise, but that's been the desire here is to get them just to suspend their program temporarily in order for these talks to go forward.
Amy Sullivan, I'll let you have the last word before we move on.
Well, I was just going to say that there's another sad situation going on right now in Zimbabwe, where negotiation is led by South Africa, has really just failed to move that country in a positive direction. And right now, that's really what the international community has been focusing on is the most, I think, present crisis.
Let's talk about it. Here's Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State. She spoke on Tuesday about the election violence in Zimbabwe.
We and the international community yesterday with the UN Security Council have called on the government of Zimbabwe to stop the violence against the opposition, to give the Zimbabwean people a chance to form a decent government that would be a legitimate government that would represent them all.
And then after withdrawing from Zimbabwe's runoff election, the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, emerged from the Dutch embassy on Wednesday to urge African and world leaders into action. He called for an immediate end to the election violence.
Let me be clear. This cannot be a part-time mediation effort. Neither can it be a continuation of talks about talks that have largely largely been fruitless for several years. The time for action is now. The people and the country can wait no longer.
Morgan Tsvangirai there. Michael Gerson, what's your take on the situation in Zimbabwe? You're a close watcher of Africa.
I traded emails this morning with a friend of mine who's in the parliament of Zimbabwe, an opposition leader. There are armed guards in front of his home. And maybe 80 members of the opposition have been murdered. This is an environment which most of the world recognizes where, a real election cannot take place. Mugabe's already announced that he would not accept a loss as a prospective outcome. But I have to say that, as Amy mentioned, and the role that South Africa has played in this entire crisis has been unbelievably shameful. Accommodating the tyranny in Zimbabwe, refusing to confront the problems here. Many other leaders in the region now from even Angola, but Botswana and now I think today Nigeria, they've been very, very harsh in their denunciations. South Africa has taken an entirely different approach and proven itself not particularly responsible in this conflict. Mm.
Jack Beattie, what has history shown us about dealing with dictators like Mugabe?
Well, I think it's shown us that that he's pretty much going to be able to do what he wants. Bret Stephens in the Wall Street Journal last week said, what about the Bush Doctrine, which said that domestic practices of countries are not beyond intervention. You can intervene over them. And he said, why don't the British send some troops down there, disarm Mugabe's people, arm the other people and then leave. Well, of course, they couldn't just leave and many would be killed and no public would vote for it. The fact is that we're in a world now of China rules, and the China rules are what other countries do within their borders. It's all up to them and nobody is going to intervene with military force. I think the Bush Doctrine, the largest humanitarian intervention in world history, our intervention in Iraq has given humanitarian interventions a lastingly bad name.
Let's end with Iraq here. More news of suicide bombs this week, but in Anbar province, some good news. Relatively speaking, the U.S. military is getting ready to hand over control of that region to Iraqi forces. Amy Sullivan, signs of success, at least in Anbar?
I think we're starting to see some signs. This is really, as we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, a situation where we're never quite sure if success is around the corner or if there's going to be a setback again. And I think one of the most disturbing things of the last week was the attack over the weekend by another female suicide bomber. That's really proven to be a real vulnerability within Iraq that continues. And it highlights some of the cultural problems for the U.S. and that, it's been really unacceptable for male police and security to pat down and to search Iraqi women. But it's also been very, very rare that women have been accepted into the roles of police. So it's becoming much, much easier for female suicide bombers to get past checkpoints. And I think unless there is some step that can be taken to change that, unfortunately, we may see more of a trend of female suicide bombers.
Michael Gerson, I'll give you the last word on all this. And Iraq, what do you see moving forward?
Well, things are difficult, dangerous, and much, much better than they were 2 years ago. I mean, people forget 2 years ago we thought that Iraq was on the verge of a sectarian bloodbath, and now there's really a decent chance at a decent outcome. You know, 2 years ago, Iraq was thought to be the main recruiting place for al-Qaeda in the world, and they've taken a series of hammer blows in Iraq, including the Anbar Awakening, which is really the first major Sunni uprising against al-Qaeda influence, which is really pretty extraordinary. And it was said that, you know, the main winners in the Iraq war was Iran. And now we have a government, you know, Maliki, taking on Iranian influence and becoming more popular in his own country because of it and was successful. So those are all good things, you know, difficult, but real progress.
My thanks to all of you for a wonderful, insightful discussion today. Michael Gerson of The Washington Post and the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
Amy Sullivan, senior editor at Time Magazine and author of The Party Faithful. Thanks to you, Amy.
Thank you, Jane.
And Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Appreciate it, Jack. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.